take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Pulling out the coupe at the lot, told him fuck 12, fuck SWAT, buzzing all the bells out the box. I just hit a lick with the box, had to put the stick in the box. Pour up the whole damn seal, I'ma get lazy.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. Your crib is large, so you can bring your friends too. Of music, news, and criticism, I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I won't never sell my soul, and I can back that. And I really wanna know where you at. I was at that. Where the stack at?
The city in the bulletproof Cadillac.
A little pitchy, John.
Hey, thanks, Randy. I appreciate that. If you know what that sound is, there's a good chance that you're familiar with the number one song in the country. That song is The Box, which we were just listening to. It is track 2 on the Roddy Ricch album, which came out last month, and it is a big hit on the TikTok. This week, we're going to talk about songwriting and virality, and here to join me today are two people who know a lot about getting live on the internet. Number one, it's Joe Coscarelli.
Hey, happy New Year.
Pop music reporter in the New York Times. Face of the Diary of the Song series. Have you been memed?
Only by Chris Black.
Who can relate?
Right. And Gilbert, our boss.
Really?
Yeah, he has a few GIFs of me that he likes to deploy every now and then.
Is that right?
Yeah, he makes GIFs in his free time.
And he like sends them to you?
Yeah, and I think he's used them publicly a handful of times.
Wow, Gilbert, yeah. I'm feeling unloved. To Joe's right, first time on podcast, but not the first time in my heart, it's Nick Sylvester. I've known Nick for more than a decade. Nick is one of the people who runs God Mode Music. God Mode is a record label in Los Angeles, specializing in, among other things, discovering viral talent and making songs with them. Before God Mode, Nick was in a band called Mr. Dream that you may know of. Way back in the day, Nick was a writer in the mid-2000s. That came to a bit of an unfortunate conclusion. But he pivoted, went to work for Colbert for some time, and now has been working in music for a decade or so. Also want to add that later in the episode, Amy Cliff is going to call in from London. It's a long way to talk about her recent article about pop songwriting and TikTok and social media and things of that nature. So we will be with Amy later in the episode.
What do you need from me?
I wish everybody would approach podcasts with that kind of sui generis energy. He's in town.
Brought my Mandarin collar.
That's right.
I wasn't kidding about it.
I know you weren't.
I got this shirt for podcast.
I know you weren't, and I wasn't kidding with my response. I mean, here's the thing. He asked for a dress code.
Do you wear shirts like this, John?
In 1994, I had an Armani Exchange shirt that was like almost identical to that I recently rediscovered in my closet. I do think collars like that are coming back, to be totally frank. If you wear that with like a shawl collar cardigan.
It's interesting you
murder,
say that.
Murder.
I have a lapel-less jacket that I often
wear this
with. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
No collars in 2020.
I've never seen this side of you, Nick.
Okay, first of all, in 2020, if you're not going to come sartorially correct to podcast, do not come at all.
Are you going to start doing a fit check at the top of episodes? Like some of our buddy podcasts?
Should we just say, welcome to the new Lawrence and James podcast, Throwing Fits?
It's the first episode
of
Throwing Fits.
Yeah, Throwing Fits. This is it. But I appreciate that people understand that podcast is ceremony, and ceremony demands outfit. So virality is changing a lot of things about how pop music kind of on a granular level is being made. And so Joe is here because Joe spends a lot of time thinking about virality. Nick is here because Nick spends a lot of time maybe engineering virality. We're going to talk about
that? Yeah, we can talk about whatever.
Okay.
I'll be whatever you want.
Wow. Yeah. Again,
I love this.
I love the enthusiasm.
Seriously, I'm here to be helpful.
Let's talk briefly about the Roddy song. So Roddy Ricch is a rapper from Los Angeles who is a former protege of Nipsey Hussle, who kind of if I'm being generous, has kind of stumbled into having the number one song in the country. Not that I dislike Roddy Ricch, but I would not say that The Box is
It's
not how we would think of hits. I think Roddy has other songs that are much more...
Five more obvious hits on this album.
To say nothing of hits that he's had with other people.
Right.
What exactly happened, Joe, with The Box that got us here?
I wish I knew.
You didn't watch the TikTok compilation YouTube?
close listeners of the podcast will know that we called Roddy Ricch, I think, at the end of 2018 or beginning
like
of 2019.
Prank call?
We called Roddy Ricch. We told him that his daughter was in the principal's office. No, we put a little spotlight on him. He had, you know, a few songs that were YouTube hits, I would say, which is definitely a genre of rap hit, especially in the last 5 years, as there were maybe in the 5 years before that. But there's like a new round of YouTube rappers. You know, his breakout song, Die Young, is super melodic, filled with a lot of melancholy.
He's an nth wave sad rap singer.
Yeah. And
maybe
not
as sad as NBA Youngboy or Rod Wave or any of these guys. Like, not that, but like he's accessible. And ultimately, the thing that I think probably is most interesting about Roddy Ricch is he does seem like the logical pop endpoint of kind of 5 years of like Young Thug almost hits.
Right. So if you listen to this Roddy Ricch album, I think especially in the first half, when you hear a lot of originality. He has a versatile voice. He has good ear for beats and for little hooks, like within hooks.
Within. He jerks his voice in different directions when it's called for, et cetera, et cetera.
But you also hear a lot of Future and a lot of Thug.
Yes.
He's very much a student of Atlanta rap, even though he's from Los Angeles.
Yes.
I actually am curious, we can come back to this, if you hear any... What is the L.A. lineage, basically, of Roddy Ricch's sound? We can come back to that. Mm-hmm. Just think on it for a minute.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, you hear, yes, a lot. It's a perfected version of a lot of the experimenting, I think, that Future and Thug did, you know, throughout the last decade. And The Box is a really tight version of it, in which, you know, the subject matter is pretty straightforward.
He's not an innovator in that space.
And he is a good storyteller when he wants to be, but I don't think this song is a particularly good example of it. What this song does have is a moment.
It has a weird sound effect
where his voice is making... People are saying that it's a door creak. I hear it as a windshield wiper. It's just...
I mean, on TikTok, it's either.
You know, from what I've read and watched about this song, it was something he added after the fact.
Same session, but at the end of the
session.
Yeah,
that this song was a straight-ahead pop trap song. And then he added this little sprinkle of Salt Bae. I'm doing the arm thing.
Thank you.
And it was this sound effect that he makes with his voice. That's
while you're here, Salt Bae, just FYI, still going in 2020.
Yeah,
his videos.
I see
are
the restaurants. Also,
IGTV's 2 to 3 minutes is incredibly effective. He's still doing it. I'm very proud of him.
So you know, he sprinkled the truffle salt on top of this pretty generic song.
I forget that truffle salt. I'm not up on that.
Oh yeah, and then all of a sudden you have a thing that kids creating content can latch onto. And that's, I think, how I hear the reason this song is working. Yes, it's catchy. Yes, he has a good voice. Yes, it sounds good and it's well made. But to me, it's like this little nugget that everyone knows is the Roddy Ricch.
The calling card.
Yeah, it's a calling card.
It's sort of House of Pain jump around when you hear the bagpipes.
Mm-hmm. Nick, making songs is a big part of your life. And I wonder what you're hearing when you hear a choice like that in the Roddy Ricch record, and maybe if you could also explain to the people what God Mode is about and kind of the path that has gotten you here.
Sure. Yeah, I co-run an artist development company called God Mode in LA, and we take people who often don't even think of themselves as artists, but they resonate in some way. And this is to your article about how music moves and what is a hit. A hit is 95% something you've heard and 5% stuff you haven't, or some sort of weird little switch to it. So for me, that's something that we're constantly thinking about when we're trying to develop an artist and find a slot for them is, you know, if they have a weird voice, what are the accoutrements of the production or the language that you're going to use that will make people feel comfortable with, you know, the new thing that you're putting in front of them. If there's too much newness, it's just a little bit too intense for people.
So do you find when you're working with someone who's relatively untested or unproven, you kind of have to make a choice between oddity in the voice and or or rather oddity in the voice or oddity in the production or oddity in the songwriting. Something you can have one slight outlier, but maybe not all of them.
I wouldn't say it's per project, but I would say that just in any given situation, take Taylor Swift, she'll sing a melody of it's the same note over and over and over again. It's the same tone, but that will draw you into the lyrics because you're not paying attention to the contours of the melody. You're paying attention to the words. You might be paying attention also to the way that she's saying the words, which is a very important thing for how she does it. So in many ways, the composition is a vehicle for her to perform the composition, and she's leaving room for herself to perform it. So I'm thinking about this stuff all the time.
So to what degree are platforms like TikTok, like things that emphasize short, unusual, potentially quirky micro sections of songs, to what degree does that influence what you're working on with artists? And are you seeking out artists who specifically can thrive in those ecosystems?
I think that the answer is yes and yes. Technology has always changed the kinds of records that are made. And also a recording itself is a performance. And so recordings themselves are a technology, and that changed what could and would be performed. You have someone like Chet Baker who probably couldn't have a career without a Ribbon microphone.
Right.
You know, he couldn't have a career without being able to sing really closely to a mic, because before that, being a singer meant having to be able to belt. And so microphonics and even the way that tape saturates and all of this other stuff that's always changed, the 45 as a format, there's only so much room on a 45.
Yeah, the single determines the length of
it. So it determines the length, and this is just how technology fits things. So I think with TikTok, so to pull back for a second, I think it's always been you need like a weird sound. You need the baby sound in the Aaliyah record. Yeah. You need a crazy sample to draw people in. You're always looking for that one element that's going to open the door for people. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's changed. I don't think that we're entering an era of weird sounds. That's not what pushes it. But I think I'd say with TikTok, if you have a song or a recording that leaves room for somebody to interact with it, and this is something that I think is really, really, really crucial about TikTok, and this is something that's special about it beyond it just being a way for the Chinese government to harbor data about people and create deepfakes. I think that it's showing that people want to do more with music than just to listen to it. They want to interact with it. They want to touch it in the same way that with photographs, they didn't want to just look at them. They wanted to be in them. They wanted to manipulate them. So if you have a song that leaves room for people to interact with it, the thing that's exciting to me about TikTok is that, you know, right now people are just lip syncing, and that's not even interaction 1.0.
And it's worth saying in terms of interactivity, I mean, this is something that was always so powerful about the kind of first interactions of the meme ecosystem with pop music, is it really showed for the first time that listening was not purely a passive activity. To listen to a song meant that you wanted to somehow absorb it into yourself and perhaps make the song part of your own creativity. And so Dub Smash, that was a thing from 3 or 4 years ago, that app that was like the lip sync act that feels like a little bit of a precursor to what TikTok and Triller have become.
Yeah, and Musical.ly, obviously, and Musical.ly, which became TikTok.
Right. But prior to that, I mean, even I'm thinking about like the Hotline Bling moment, where you have this video that's basically expressly created to create a meme interaction. And then things like TikTok and people building skits on TikTok off of song snippets feels like the next logical, more technologically advanced step for that.
Yeah. If anything, it's revealing that pop music has always been memetic.
Yeah.
And you wrote about this in your piece. You see this in rap where the sound of a snare drum changes every 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, we're using a clap that has a little bit more of decay on it all of a sudden. I mean, this is why Jack Antonoff seemed like such a fool when he made that Taylor Swift record, her trap record.
Right.
He
was using what you made me do.
It was like he typed like trap kit into Reddit in the Wayback Machine. Like it was just like, it was just very, because he wasn't paying attention.
It was the wrong snare.
Yeah. Right. The pocket of where the hi-hats were. It's like, you know, he didn't push back the hi-hats a little bit. Like all these little things that he just wasn't paying attention.
Sure.
Or he wasn't paying, or maybe it was a deliberate decision. But that's, to me,
yeah,
it's,
I mean,
like,
it's possible he felt he couldn't locate Taylor too squarely in like the contemporary, but you can locate her as sort of a late adopter.
Whatever it was, but like that as a harsh example, and not to take anything away from either of them, but also to take things away from both of them, is that, you know, you have to be paying attention to the language of things that are happening if you are trying to make pop music, and that's what a meme is.
One of the things that I find most fascinating about TikTok is the ruthlessness of TikTok, the speed of it, the quickness and almost like harshness of the decision making, where like songs that maybe ostensibly would be popular in another era, even if that era was like 2017, just like can go to TikTok to die. Whereas things that organically are not designed that way, like the Roddy record or whatever, kind of like get yanked up out of the ether and then recrafted. And then that fundamentally remakes not just what's on the pop charts, but also I assume people are scrambling in every record label office to say, well, that happened. Why didn't that happen with my guy or my woman? Or why is that? Why is our group not thriving?
Yeah, I think there's one thing that is really misunderstood about how things work on TikTok is how there are TikTok creators who have huge followings, and these are people who they don't know what they want to do. Like they're not like, I want to become an actor. I want to become a model.
They want to be in Hype House.
They have no money. They have a phone and they're just looking for something to do. And this is a thing to do.
Do you think that you approach TikTok in a different way than the casual user might approach TikTok?
Yes.
What are the things that you find yourself either gravitating to or gravitating away from?
I think that a typical A&R at a record label is looking to listen for the songs that are taking off on TikTok. I'm looking for TikTok users. I'm looking for people who have maybe 30,000 followers. And I just kind of like their energy. I'm kind of looking for people.
To make into musicians?
To make into musicians. Or people who seem that they have a musical energy to them.
But do you fundamentally feel like you can make the record, but you can't manufacture the energy? So if you find the energy, you can do the rest.
Yeah. And
or
I think
you can help.
I can tease it out.
You
yeah,
can arrive
exactly.
at it.
And making a record is about what's the statement that comes from this person and just helping them figure it out. And it's a dance, you know. And sometimes you figure it out in like two records. Other times you figure it out in one, and other times they've kind of already figured it out, but it's not a song. It's just a vibe. And so it's just a very different way of thinking about what we're doing.
You had a viral success recently.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that and we can listen to it and like
sure,
learn and hopefully learn from it?
The name of the song is Boyfriend, which is spelled in a bizarre way, B-O-Y-F-R-E-N. And the artist is named Love Leo, mm-hmm. and he is a 21-year-old from outside of LA, and he is fluid in every regard, I'd mm-hmm. say. Like, he just reminds me of the way Beck hit me in the early 90s. Like, what is he? Is he taking the piss? He's just kind of emerged as a true artist in a really special way. Mm-hmm. But we discovered him on TikTok and we just liked his TikToks.
And what were the TikToks that you initially found?
They were just him doing little sleight of hand videos, and not that dissimilar to the way Vine used to work.
Yeah.
You know, just really funny.
R.I.P. Vine.
It wasn't like he was participating in the top-down challenges, though sometimes you have to do that, and that's how you gain followers on the platform. But it was just his energy and his look and the attention to detail and the ways that people were interacting with him. They were curious about him. They didn't just want to look at him.
And was he a musician in any meaningful sense?
So it turned out that he had been making music just for fun with his friends called Boy Band. They would just hang out and they would just kind of rap into autotune or sing. And you would just kind of use the words that people use. But Leo's the one that after the song's finished and people are like, want to play video games, he'd start making the music video. And that kind of energy, that burst of creative energy, it's really, really special.
And so you want to give that person more resources,
more
attention, more resources, and hopefully more success.
Exactly, yes.
The record that you landed on, let's actually listen to Boyfriend. How long did it take for you to arrive at deciding that this is what he needed? Is that his preferred pronoun?
Yes.
Okay.
We had written about 10 or 15 songs together, and he had done a few as well with a few other people. And the songs were getting too good. They were getting too mature too quickly. Like, really just, they just sounded too much like music. And he's like, oh, I made this one like last night. And he just made it on his bed. And he sang it into his MacBook microphone, sitting cross-legged on his bed, and he just kind of sang it. And it was so obviously the right thing. It was so obviously the right first song, if that makes sense. And it scanned well with how he looked and and his energy and all. And it was just so obvious. So even though there are songs that are probably better songs and are in any sort of like classic sense, it was so obvious that that was the one, and it had that energy.
You just said something that really opened up a perspective for me, and I'd be curious to hear what you guys think about it, which is you said that he was making songs that were too good. And this song was not that. And I wonder if what we're starting to see in the context of TikToks and Trillers is something that is kind of music, but not quite. There's some other thing that's a standalone thing. Now, obviously, it's being tracked on the music charts, something that's successful on TikTok, becomes a Billboard hit. So it functions as music in that way. But the actual medium is something that's not quite music.
I think you've always seen a youth culture interest in rawness, though, right? Like, that's what punk is, like, you know, I can't play guitar. I'm going to figure it out anyway. And you see the same thing come around again in the SoundCloud thing. When every time rap or the pop mainstream gets a little too glossy, like after the Katy Perry era or whatever, or after the Drake era, you know, then it goes flips back to being a little dirtier again. And I think, like, when you think of through lines between music that has come up from nowhere to go viral on Vine or TikTok or whatever, even thinking of like Bobby Shmurda or something.
Sure.
It's like a little bit raw, and you think about the blown out bass of like XXXTentacion, which persists through viral rap songs on TikTok now, for like thinking like Tokyo's Revenge, this new guy, or Sweko the Child, or that kind of stuff, like all has an element of amateurism to it that matches the visual component.
But is it even something more than that? That basically what you're seeing on TikTok is not the success of songs, but the success of some hybrid of music, theatricality, something that's narrative driven, something that you couldn't even necessarily identify purely as music. I wonder if what exists in this ecosystem should even be discussed, strictly speaking, by the same terms. I know it's being tracked by the same mechanisms, but should it be discussed in the same way? Like, is the thing, Nick, that you're trying to make when you make something that's successful in that universe, you're not trying to make a successful song. You're trying to create something that exists outside of that slightly.
Often you're just looking to be suggestive and to imply that there's a lot more there. A good example of this is, it's not a good example. This is a very lengthy example, but it's the only example I can come up with, and I feel safe in this room.
Safe room.
So
think about how padded these walls are.
Do you remember the Tobias Wolff book, Old School? It's a book about a kid who went to a fictionalized version of Hill School, and he wants to be a writer. But at the beginning, there's this really lovely part where the narrator talks about how writing in fragments, like, you never want to finish anything because a fragment still has the possibility of being perfect. But if you finish the song and it's not good, then it's just not a good song. But a fragmented song, something that is kind of deliberately unfinished sounding, or that it has the possibility of being
gestures
perfect.
Toward possibility.
Yeah. Right.
On top of that, is part of the possibility that's being gestured to a thing that is not made by the song creator, because ultimately you're leaving, as you said before, you're leaving blank space. You're leaving implied participation. And the path of a TikTok success is not complete without the full circle loop of people embracing, reinterpreting, reposting, et cetera. So in a sense, whatever success a song has on TikTok, the artist gets credit for it, but really it's this kind of multiplayer affair.
I would say that's true of really anything. And I think that there's definitely a lot more glee on the audience side right now to feel as if they really had something to do with the success of the artist they rallied behind. Mm-hmm. That's always a little bit scary to me, because it reminds me a little bit of, remember Firsties? Remember when people were really excited to break a record, but a critic breaking a record? So that can be unhealthy too, because right. all of a sudden you're just trying to make things popular. And the thing I say about virality is that syphilis is also viral, you know? So you know, virality is not a virtue in itself.
Oh my gosh. When did you first start thinking of boyfriend through the lens of TikTok, and what about the song works in that medium?
That's a fun question for this one, because I actually don't think the song is that TikTok-y. It became a TikTok hit because Leo was popular on the platform. It does have a homespun quality to it, but it's not the Harlem Shake model of 10 seconds of stuff. And then even Old Town Road has that
drop.
That 1-2 punch. That's easy to understand. Or the songs that have a little bit of a skit. There's none of that in this one.
I'd say the syncopation at the top, the sort of like Pharrell-esque intro, gets you close to that place.
For sure. And in that way, it's just sort of a classic first sentence. It's not trying to grab you. It's just trying to intrigue you. Here are some mechanical things about how a song gets on TikTok. Because I don't think people really know about this stuff.
No, and I think that'd be really useful, because I think, especially because so much of what's on TikTok is mislabeled also.
Our distributor, and this is an enormous distributor, was not set up to deliver the song on TikTok. This is an enormous independent distributor.
It just wasn't in the system.
Just wasn't. You can get it up on DistroKid, but you couldn't get it up on this enormous thing. And it was infuriating because—
This is how long ago?
This was in November.
Oh.
And that meant that no official version of the song could be monetized and live on TikTok?
Yeah, and so no song, I don't think recordings are monetized on TikTok right
Yet.
Now.
Yes, right. But they're tracked.
So additionally, when you upload a recording to TikTok, you have to decide what are the 15 seconds that you are uploading. This was a really upsetting thing because we had planned on having that be part of the rollout, because that's where he has a head start on his fans, and that seemed to be a place where you would start a campaign.
Yeah, sure.
And we couldn't get the song on TikTok officially because of our distributor. So he uploaded it himself. He took the 15 seconds at the top and just did it. And so—
And there's no paperwork that goes with that.
No,
you don't just
do
say
that.
Who the songwriter is, where the splits go.
Nothing.
None of that.
No, so it just says, I think the audio is hook from Love Leo Boyfriend is the name of the original sound that he uploaded. So eventually the original got on, but people still kept using the bootleg version of this.
But there is something about if the title of the song was formatted perfectly and it obviously came from a distributor, that takes away some of
the edge. Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
And this is exactly the echo of, this is what happened with Old Town Road. So there's, you know, the first person to put Old Town Road on TikTok, this TikToker, Nice Michael, cute kid from like the Boston area, just does little dances. And he said, you know, once he started building a TikTok audience.
And he found it where? He found it on SoundCloud?
Yeah. So he said that once he started building a TikTok audience, he would, you know, on his way home from school or whatever, spend 10 minutes scrolling through SoundCloud, new, trending, whatever, and try to find the soundtrack for his next TikTok dance. One day he found Old Town Road. You know, there was no official version of it on TikTok. So he uploaded the audio himself. And so for the first, you know, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 TikTok Old Town Road videos, they were using Nice Michael's upload of the song, which maybe there was a typo in it. Maybe it wasn't, you know, tagged properly. And then eventually, once, you know, Lil Nas X gets signed to Columbia, whatever, Columbia goes back channel with TikTok and they're able to replace it with the official version. So then it can do the things that it needs to do in capitalism.
Wait, can we listen to Old Town Road?
A
song that I haven't heard in 6 months?
Who doesn't want to hear Old Town
Road? Let's listen to Old Town
Road. OG Old Town Road.
Yes, 1.0, pre-Billy Ray.
Yeah, I'm going to take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm going to ride till I can't no more. I'm going to take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm going to ride till I can't.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the bushes black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch. Now, can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Riding on a track, lean all in my blood.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Joe, can you talk a little bit about, you were saying that deals are in the works. So right now, if a song is used on TikTok under the incorrect name or a slightly correct name or even the correct name, is it being tracked? Who's tracking it? Who's making money, if anybody, right now?
I don't believe, and Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe anybody is making money. I don't believe there are royalties attached to TikToks right now. And I think, you know, the major labels, as they do, are constantly in contact with these sort of companies where people are using the things they own to create content. And eventually that could be part of the thing. You know, this happened with Facebook a couple years ago. You know, it's happened with Instagram, obviously YouTube. So I think right now it's a multi-step process. The song takes off on TikTok. You can see how many people have made a video to that song. That's obviously a huge metric if you're trying to get a label deal or whatever. And then the next step is people go onto Spotify, onto Apple Music, onto SoundCloud, and they search that song. And so what the feedback loop that I see, and again, Nick, you can jump in here if you disagree, but basically, if you look at the viral 50 chart, for instance, on Spotify, you know basically that the first five songs are probably
TikTok songs.
They probably took off on TikTok first, maybe some other social network, maybe Triller, maybe something else, but probably they're TikTok songs. And that's a result, I think, of people hearing the lyric or whatever. And this is an important background thing that I don't think a lot of people think about. If you have a clip going viral on TikTok, what are people going to search for? They're going to search for the word that sticks out to them in that little snippet. Then they're going to go to Spotify and they're going to type boyfriend. Maybe they hear it as boyfriend and they type the real name. And like, I don't know, that's a whole other thing you have to think about.
One tricky, I'm just going to call it a fun detail of many major label deals, is that if the major label or the parent company negotiates a blanket deal for licensing with an entire platform, like the music that's going to be in elevators.
Right. Yeah.
So say Sony does a deal with Mood Music, they're the new Muzak, and this is probably inaccurate in this example, but if you do a blanket deal for licensing across all of
the catalog,
all of the entire catalog, and it's not attached to any specific artist's name, a lot of major label deals do not pay the artists royalties on behalf of that. That's just sort of a blanket deal that they made.
And none of that trickles down?
And potentially none of that trickles down. Depending on the blanket deal, there are blanket licensing agreements that just are not reflected in the royalty statements to the artists. I say that without judgment because I don't want to get myself in trouble. So I have no judgment on the matter. But
I can't wait for some rapper to start complaining about not getting paid for his elevator usage. I can't. Like Styles P is going to just be like, and another thing is I was in an elevator. And yeah.
Where the artists who are big on TikTok are winning right now is in getting label deals. And I think we, you know, you're increasingly seeing, whereas the sort of gold rush of SoundCloud, that's sort of dried up right now for, you know, labels checking the viral SoundCloud charts
and then Lil Pump
going to sign that person. Now it's the songs that are popular on TikTok. And, you know, you have 15 seconds that blow up on this platform, and then all of a sudden you have Warner Brothers or whoever knocking at your door. And, you know, we've seen a large number of these deals in the last few months. You think of a song like Roxanne. I don't even know the guy's name.
Arizona Zervas.
Arizona Zervas. We should listen to a little bit of that.
No, let's not.
The people need to know.
Deep sigh.
Roxanne, Roxanne, all she wanna do is party all night. Goddamn, Roxanne, never gonna love me, but it's alright. She think I'm a SF, she think I'm a player. She keep running back though, only cause I pay her. Roxanne, Roxanne, all she wanna do is party all night. Met her at a party in the hills, yeah. She just wanna do it for the thrill, yeah. Shorty drive a poodle with no top. But if I throw this money, she gon' drop. Ay. She don't wait in lines if it's too long.
I was actually thinking of, along these lines, an early-ish TikTok hit, and that's the Boy Boy West Coast.
Where is he now?
I'm sort of curious. I feel like 12 months later, we might have to recover the history of the Boy Boy West Coast. But to the point, Joe, you're saying someone blows up on TikTok and all these record companies are swarming. And I think that circles right back to what I was asking before, which is what exactly does it mean to be successful on TikTok? Does it mean you're a successful musician? And Nick, I wonder, to kind of like wrap it up, do you fundamentally think that what's going to emanate from TikTok, the ecosystem of successful performers, are those going to be people who thrive in the conventional music industry, or is something about the business going to evolve to accommodate these kind of like maybe slightly more polyvalent talent?
TikTok is just a foot in the door. In order to have a career in music, you do need to have somebody throwing money behind you and supporting you and making sure that what you make cuts through the noise of everything else that's happening in the world. So I think that if you are a person who's excited about making music and music is what you want to do, that's a pretty good idea to kind of get a foot in the door. And so I think a lot of TikTok songs in many ways are kind of like Beck's Loser, or at least with Leo. I think this song is his – this is his Beck's Loser, and now it's kind of on him to make his Midnight Vultures.
I'm glad you're taking this metaphor all the way through the episode.
Right. No, for sure. No, for sure. So that's what this could be. This could be the goof song that this, you know.
For people who aspire exactly, in that direction.
Exactly.
But not everybody does.
And so I guess the somewhat counterintuitive thing that I'm interested in and excited about is I would rather have not this be a place where stars are born, but creating a universe where people feel comfortable making music as a casual way of expression, in the way that we romanticize non-American cultures, that music is part of the daily bread of being alive, and not just this consumer mediated situation where, you know, a top-down thing. I would love a world where you could not just lip sync to Lovely Old Boyfriend, but you could take the instrumental and Weird Al it really quickly and have it sound and have autotune locked in. I'd love it for you to be able to take the whistle and turn it into something else. I'd love for you just to be able to say it's like you're really uncomfortable in a room or whatever, for you to kind of be able to say it's getting hot in here in a Nelly voice, you know?
How far away are
I think
we
we're
from
about
that?
Well, some of the tech is there. The main issue is just going to be rights holders, contemporary rights holders, and rethinking copyright.
Sure.
But the tech is pretty close, and I think that what we're seeing right now is the beginning of people wanting that return to music as something that they interact with, not merely purchase and listen to.
Nick, thanks for coming. Let's transition into part two. Let's pour one out for a real one. This is Boy Boy West Coast. You was at the club.
Drugs, hates being sober, in my psyche, in my head.
So to pick up on the themes that we were just talking about with Nick Sylvester, Amy Cliff is calling in. Amy, what's good?
Hey, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. So Amy is a writer in London, used to work at The Fader, used to work at Days, now writes for The Guardian and for Pitchfork. And Amy wrote a piece a few days ago about songwriting. And the aspects of that piece that really jumped out at me were about the ways in which people who are professional songwriters, trudging into the studio day in, day out, how they are thinking about their job differently in the wake of TikTok and virality and so on and so forth. So I wanted to have Amy on to talk about it. Here we are. Amy, when you went into this piece, was that the framing that you went in with, or was it something that you uncovered through the course of interviews?
I had an idea that that was kind of loosely the framing. I wanted to explore, you know, obviously it was the end of the decade. We've been talking so much about the end of the 2010s. And I was thinking about that role of being a professional jobbing songwriter and how the goalposts have shifted so much in various ways. And a lot of that is to do with social media and streaming and virality. And so I wanted to kind of throw all those things just into the conversation and see if it was affecting songwriters in the ways that I suspected it might be. Because you hear a lot of stuff about like, oh, songs don't have, you know, long intros anymore because people skip songs right. too much when they're listening on Spotify. And I wanted to speak to songwriters about like, do they literally sit in a writing room and say, oh, we can't have an intro longer than 5 seconds on this song, you know?
And it's important just, you know, we always like to remind the listeners, you know, there are people who are famous, you know, your Taylor Swifts who like sit in their room and bang out a song more or less fully formed that they then take into a studio. But many, many more songs that end up becoming pop hits are committee productions. You know, they're made by behind the scenes teams of writers and producers and bridge specialists and so on and so forth. So your focus was to really talk to those behind the scenes people. Some of them have recording careers, but you really wanted to focus on the people whose livelihood really depends on being as current as possible. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I'm really interested in that process and like the amount of people that it takes to make a good pop song happen, I guess.
Right.
And also I was interested in, especially right now, we have these disruptors in the charts. Like you have someone like Billie Eilish who sort of come out yep. of nowhere and does it on her own with Phineas. And then, you know, I wanted to speak to professional songwriters who've been doing this for a long time about how they then respond to these kind of new competitors coming in, because it almost feels like there's a sense that it's anyone's game right now.
Did you find them anxious when you spoke to them?
I expected to find them a bit more anxious than I did, maybe.
maybe they weren't willing to tell you how anxious they
yeah,
were.
Yeah, right. I think maybe they were putting on a like brave front. I don't know. But they kind of, a lot of them talked about feeling invigorated by that. Because I think something that really came out of the conversations was there's almost like a directive or impetus to be weirder right now, yep. like to experiment more, especially with little production flourishes or just like putting in like a really weird, like memorable line, or just creating something that's like more experimental, because there's a sense that no one quite knows what's going to stick when you throw it at the charts at the moment. So it's almost like right. it pays to try and be weirder.
You know, one of the things that happens in those kind of like by committee spaces is you do have this kind of homogeneity that ends up taking over. Everybody's moving in the same direction. Everybody's trying to iterate just one bit beyond what else is out or popular at that moment. And there is this unexpected thing that's happening a lot on the charts now, or certainly with viral hits, where it's not predictable what the thing is that's going to capture ultimately teenagers' attention. Mm. And it really could be anything. It could be a sound effect. It could be a weird drum pattern. It could be, you know, a vocal skit that's part of a record but not really central to the record. So it is kind of much more of an open field. Your takeaway from that is that the songwriters, the pros, were actually kind of happy about that, or at least open-minded to it.
One of the people I spoke to, her name is Camille Purcell. She goes just by the name Camille. She does writing for a lot of British artists, so like Little Mix and Mabel. She talked about it, like she was really excited about, you know, she'll come into the studio and she'll kind of go through what songs are charting at the moment on streaming services. And then also she'll look at TikTok, and she loves TikTok. She finds that like an exciting place to go and look for the strangest things that are kind of popping off among teenagers at the moment, and they're taking inspiration from that. And she talks about taking inspiration from the language of like memes and how people talk on social media as well, which I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I really like the image because you mentioned that in your article. I like the idea of her sort of like clocking into work. And the first thing she does when she sits down at the table is like scrolls through TikTok for 15 minutes to try to find like the sliver or an iota of a half inspiration to build on. You know, right. Like that's work now. Like that's not just what simply you do, like scrolling aimlessly in bed before you go to sleep. Like that's actually part of the job.
It's like a journalist coming in the morning and, you know, looking at the New York Times or looking at the news.
And also the thing about language, you had talked in the article about people saying that the language choices were more, I don't know if intimate's the right word, but maybe more casual, more spoken, less kind of theatrical and abstract. Is that right?
Yeah. So this for me was almost the biggest takeaway from talking to everyone that I spoke to, because actually, quite a lot of the songwriters that I spoke to all echoed it. They talked about, like, if you look back to the early 2010s, there were songs like Titanium by Sia, or I think like Firework by Katy Perry is another good example, where you kind of, you'd have this one central image and then you kind of get that and you go, okay, that's my chorus. And then you build out like, okay, how many different ways can we interpret and dance around this image in the verses and kind of build it out. And all the songwriters that I spoke to talked about that shifting to really now artists will walk into the writer's room and say, I don't want to sing it if I wouldn't say it. And I do think that's probably related to like, people want lyrics now to be able to use them to like subtweet someone or to put it as a caption on Instagram when you post a selfie and you're being like coy that you've posted a selfie. So you put like a lyric underneath, like people want to quote them. They want things to be relatable and people just want it to be conversational.
Obviously, the very nature of TikTok, the whole point of TikTok, you know, it's not like Dub Smash from 4 years ago where you're just lip syncing a song. Some people do that on TikTok, but really it's about user participation. It's about absorbing the snippet of the song into a performance or a sketch that some kid is going to do. So you can't have something that's too abstract because the whole point of engagement is to get them to do something that seems natural but is a performance that ends up boosting the virality of the track. And so if you had something that was a little bit too big picture or a little bit difficult, it'd be hard to do. Like I think of the Iggy Azalea thing. Walk a mile in these Louboutins, and then everybody does the kind of fake shoes where they're increasingly elaborate and they always fall over.
Walk a mile in these Louboutins.
You couldn't do that if the imagery wasn't so clear, if the statement wasn't so specific to a person doing a thing. And you know, pop music is not always about that. You know, pop music can be about abstract feelings, it could be about romance, it kind of addresses these large themes, but isn't necessarily about individual behavior. And I do think what you're seeing in this era, and you get at this in your piece, are songs moving in the direction of individual action, individual behavior.
Right. Emenike, another writer that I spoke to, he talked about really the changing nature of the amount of things that you can write about as a songwriter. He was kind of saying that a few years ago, it felt like every song was very much kind of, you know, you broke up with me, you broke my heart, you cheated on me, or I love you. And that was kind of the remit of what he was doing when he was writing Top Lines. Whereas like now he's saying that, you know, he's having much more vulnerable conversations with artists and writers' rooms. They want to bring in mental health issues. They want to be vulnerable. They want to talk about all the things that are in the charts at the moment.
And one of the things that you talked about is that part of this is happening because of the way hip hop has reframed kind of what pop songcraft is. So tell me a little bit about what the people you interviewed said about that.
Yeah, well, again, Camille, who I spoke to, she really thought that the fact that hip hop has become such a dominant force in the charts in the last few years has contributed to the fact that you see a lot more minimal laid back production on pop, and it's kind of slowed the tempo of pop and made everything, how did she put it? She said that like it used to be the thing that you wanted to try and get the biggest chorus, but now people want to make like the coolest chorus.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I feel like when you listen to the charts now, yeah, if you think about something like Firework by Katy Perry, it was all just building to that chorus and then the chorus would just like go off. And I think the tendency now is to kind of pull back, which I think is partly comes from hip hop. I think it also comes from like EDM dominance in charts in the last few years as well.
you look at the breakout success that Bieber had through a kind of quasi EDM lens mm-hmm. 5 years ago or 6 years ago, and you contrast that with Yummy, which, you know, has none of those flourishes, and it, if anything, is designed for social dissemination much more than anything else. And it's not even that, it's not that complicated of a chorus, it's not that complicated of an idea, you know, it's a very boiled down and boiled off version of what Bieber used to do. It's interesting because I always thought him kind of coming into pop super success on the back of EDM always felt false. Like, he always did feel like kind of like a low-key R&B singer to me. So it's interesting that in this moment where, you know, virality and quick phrases, conversational phrases are such the coin of the realm, that he's completely pulled back from that and gone down that road, which is probably a more natural road for him anyway.
I think Yummy kind of sounds like Journals to me. It kind of sounds like what he was doing.
That's right.
The Full Purpose, yeah.
Respect Journals. Put some respect on Journals. Put exactly. some respect. If you're listening to podcast right now, pause it and go play Journals and then come back. Or don't. Just go play Journals. It's absolute 100% right. So the people that you spoke with, when you were asking them about a year from now, 3 years from now, did they see this direction that things are going as something that was going to continue to go that way? Or were they saying this felt more like a blip or a phase and it would kind of like pull back towards classic songwriting?
I think they all just see it as quite unpredictable. Like, So one of the groups of people that I spoke to, it's a trio of songwriters and producers called TMS. They have had a bunch of number ones in the UK over the years, but in the US, you would know them because they worked on Someone You Loved by Lewis Capaldi this year. And obviously, these guys are
big tune.
These guys are like the anomaly in the people that I spoke to, really, because Someone You Loved is not any of the things that we've just talked about.
And right. Yeah. No, that's true. It's the anti this. It's the anti TikTok song.
Right. And it's funny that something like that, that is just a straight piano ballad, can be as big as it is also while all of these other things are happening. So there's a sense that there's kind of all to play for. And I think that when they talked about writing that song, they said, if you could hear the full recording of the song, you would hear that we finished playing it and then we just turned to each other and said, okay, shall we record the next one? Like, they didn't necessarily think it was, they weren't like, wow, what an amazing thing we've just done. It's going to be a number one. Like, they didn't think it would be a number one when they wrote that. There was a consensus that, like, there isn't really a consensus at the minute. I know that's an unsatisfying conclusion, but.
No. But maybe the way that you and I can fix it is when we're done. No, I have a solution. When we're done, let's start TikTok accounts and start TikToking Someone You Loved.
Okay.
Let's just put it in that ecosystem. Let's just feed it into the machine and recycle it out of the normal context and like put it in like a weird skit, strange, sad kid context. Okay. And like, I think we can give it a whole second life.
You just have to loop it and like get sadder and sadder each time.
Right, exactly. It's like exponentially sadder. It's gonna be great. Okay, so we're gonna go to everybody, if you're listening, everybody go TikTok Someone You Loved. Everybody has a homework task. Amy, thank you for calling in to talk to us about virality and TikTok. And I will see you in the feed.
Yes. See you on the feed. Thanks for having me.
Let's go out with a little bit of that Justin Bieber, Yummy.
Yeah, you got that yummy, yum, that yummy, yum, that yummy, yummy. Yeah, you got that yummy, yum, that yummy, yum, that yummy, yummy.
Say the word on my way.
Yeah, babe, yeah, babe, yeah, babe. Any night, any day.
Say the word.
That's our show. Thank you to Joe Coscarelli. Thank you to Nick Sylvester. Thank you to Amy Cliff. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to the podcast TikTok feed. Nah, I'm just kidding. I don't have one. Should we start TikTok, Pedro?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe we'll start TikTok feeds. TBD. Listen to every podcast ever.
Email us your questions about TikTok. Maybe email me the TikToks that you make about Louis Capaldi at popcastnytimes.com, and subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content: Stitcher, Google Play, Pandora, etc., Apple Podcast app. Subscribe to us there. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
Lost control of myself, I'm compromised. You're incriminating, no disguise. And you ain't never running low on supplies.